Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hi, thanks for joining. Please make sure you subscribe to follow us on all the various platforms here on the podcast, as well as on YouTube. The stuff we write on Substack, as well as quick takes on Instagram and on Threads. If you're enjoying what we're putting out there, please make sure you're sharing with all your friends and family. And if you have questions or comments about the stuff we're putting out there, please make sure you leave them in comments to us. We'll be more than happy to cover them in future talks. There has recently been some new research indicating that forgetfulness, memory loss, and a host of neurodegenerative diseases have at the heart of them metabolic issues. Issues that impact the ability to clear metabolic waste from the brain and can even cause storage of the neuron's fuel sources, glucose, where there should not be storage. So, is memory loss, dementia, and possibly neurodegenerative diseases a metabolic issue? Well, let's talk about that.
Warning. The following presentation contains information that might contradict what you have previously heard, or believed to be true, about how the human body works, and contains material that is not suitable for closed-minded individuals. Enjoy.
When we start looking at the issue and the idea about neurodegenerative diseases, and the impact that metabolism has on those neurodegenerative diseases, we have to look at two separate issues coming into play here. We will go ahead and look at neurodegenerative issues in a whole, pull in some stuff that we looked at in our pathology series that's on the YouTube channel in terms of the discussion here. The biggest issue that we have as it relates to what's going on with this idea about metabolic issues being at the heart of the neurodegenerative diseases, and particularly the degenerative diseases associated with memory loss and with Alzheimer's disease, with Lewy body diseases, with diseases that we attribute dementia changes to, is that for the longest time, we were going down the wrong path. And we were going down the wrong path because we were led astray based off of what has now been referenced as fraudulent studies. But it's not really as fraudulent as what most people would think about in terms of those that like to question the scientific validity and scientific veracity of some of the less recent studies, where it indicated the fact that we were having these changes in terms of amyloid distribution, in particular for this beta amyloid plaque that would develop around the axons and within the synapses of people who have neurodegenerative diseases. Whenever there is disruption of the neuronal functions, whenever there is any type of excessive inflammation, whenever there's any type of excessive damage to the neurons, two distinct proteins start to develop in and around the axons and the synapses of those neurons, and that is amyloid and tau protein. Amyloid and tau protein should have a normal shape to them. However, when we start getting damage to these neurons, whether it is from metabolic conditions or whether it's from actual trauma, which we see with people who have chronic traumatic encephalopathy or post-concussive syndromes, where the amyloid proteins and the tau proteins get misshaped and form what's referred to as a prion within the cerebral spinal fluid, within the fluid that surrounds the neurons of the brain, they lead to disruption of neuronal functions. And because they disrupt neuronal functions, it leads to the symptoms that we associate with neurodegenerative diseases. And so there was a causal linkage to something that was not a causal linkage, it's more of a correlative linkage that's there. And so this is where people say, oh, well, it was fraudulent that we had this off-track look at simply amyloid accumulation. But it's not where it was fraudulent in the sense that the person was continuously leading us astray. It was the fact that the research was not backing up the evidence. And so when we start looking at this idea about Alzheimer's disease, about dementia issues, for decades, the discussion has been dominated based off of the amyloid and the tau and the tau proteins, the plaques and the tangles that we see, the clumps of misshaped proteins. around the synapse and around the axons that disrupt the way in which the neurons are normally functioning. One of the things that we start to look at in terms of the evidence that we have in terms of the inflammation process coming into play goes back about a decade and a half now to research coming out of Nedergaard's lab, which is now at the University of Rochester, in which we looked at what's referred to as the glyphamic system. And the glyphamic system is the linkage that we have in between the lymphatic system, the system that is used to drain fluid out of tissues and out of organs, and the cerebrospinal fluid circulation, and the circulatory system that is related to the production of cerebrospinal fluid, that is the fluid that surrounds the brain and surrounds the spinal cord, and the blood supply that's going to provide the fluid to generate that cerebrospinal fluid, and the clearance of cerebrospinal fluid through the ventricles and into the lymphatic drainage systems that occur within the connective tissue that surrounds the brain and the spinal cord, which is referred to within the arachnoid space and the paravascular spaces within these areas. And so what ends up happening is that when we start to have high amounts of metabolic activity within the neurons, those neurons will start to produce metabolic wastes. If we do not allow the metabolic waste to clear, what can happen is that we get this dysfunctional flow. And that dysfunctional flow allows for the beta amyloid proteins and the tau proteins to start to accumulate. As they start to accumulate and as they start to interact with fluids that are not homeostatically regulated in terms of the balance point, they can lead to misshaping of the proteins, and that misshape of the protein causes additional misshaping of the protein. And that is where we have an increased risk for neurodegenerative diseases from the accumulations of tau and amyloid. That doesn't mean that the tau and amyloid are the cause of the neurodegenerative diseases. It simply means that they're associated with that. And it has to deal with the impact of this fluid flow. And so one of the things we start looking at in terms of the fluid flow is the fact that how does the formation of distinct proteins within the neurons, how does distinct metabolite accumulation within and around the neurons impact that fluid flow and impact the accumulation of metabolic waste that can lead to that formation of that tau and amyloid plaque that we know disrupts neuronal functions? One of the things that has come to light recently is a protein that is associated within the hippocampus that relates to the ability for the formation of synapses and the formation of normal synaptical functions between neurons within the hippocampus and the surrounding cells to it. What that protein, which is referred to as the FTL1 gene protein, which corresponds to the ferritin light chain protein, that is a protein that is disrupting that normal process. And so when we start to have that protein at lower levels, we continue to have normal neuronal functions. However, as that protein starts to accumulate, we start to have a disruption in normal neuronal functions. And that disruption in normal neuronal functions means that we don't get the correct synapsing taking place. And if we don't get the correct synapsing taking place, we start to lose the connection points. And as we start to lose the connection points, we start to have a reduction in network activation. And that reduction in network activation means that our ability to remember things, our ability to tie things together starts to drop. And that has to deal with how we go about learning and how we go about retrieving memories that we've learned. And it has to deal with responses to synapses and responses to stresses in a process known as Habian synaptic transmissions. That is where the analogy that we usually talk about is that neurons that fire together live together, neurons that do not fire together die together. And what we're talking about in terms of that live-die function within the neurons is the connection point that's going to allow for all of the connections to remain and the neural networks to stay robust. That robustness is based off of the strengthening and weakening of synapses within the neural networks. And that strengthening and weakening within the neural networks is something that happens normally. The learning process is going to lead to synchronicity between neurons within the neuronal networks. And that synchronicity within the neuronal networks is going to allow for strengthening and weakening of neural ties, which is going to lead to strengthening and weakening of memories and retrieval of memories. And so when we start looking at this neurodegenerative issue, we start looking at the neurodegenerative issue as it relates to memory losses, as it relates to dementia issues. Having that protein start to accumulate is going to lead to a disruption in that normal neuronal functioning. And that disruption in normal neural functioning is going to lead to a loss of connection points, which means that that robust network that we develop starts to drop away. This is where we've talked about use it or lose it on a whole bunch of various issues. This comes into play when we start talking about use it or lose it for the neurons. That use it or lose it is going to make sure that the synapses that are working stay working. The connection points, the networks that are working stay working, where we're able to have good memory retrieval, not just good memory retrieval, but good memory storage. And so one of the things that happens in terms of the demential issue is that we start having a loss of memory transition. We start having a loss of long-term memory to short-term memory, short-term memory to working memory to short-term memory, short-term memory to long-term memory within that relay network that allows me to remember stuff. And that leads to a lot of the fabrication issues, at least a lot of the memory issues that we start to associate with older aged brains. We start associating with loss of cognitive function. We start worrying about, do we have to put grandma, do we have to put grandpa, do we have to put mom, do we have to put dad into an assisted living facility, an assisted living home, what some people refer to as the old folks home, simply because they have that memory issue that can lead to other output issues, that can lead to other psychological issues, that can lead to other physical issues in terms of worries that we have to worry about based off of the loss of that memory retrieval that's coming into play. Within that memory retrieval issues, within that, the ability to have robust neural networks, one of the things that has come to light within the maybe about the last 5 to 6 years is this idea about insulin responses within the neurons. And what some people refer to as type 3 diabetes in terms of the metabolic issues. And so this is the first time we're going to start looking at metabolic issues. And we'll start looking at metabolic issues in terms of this insulin resistance issue, as well as issues in terms of cofactors and issues in terms of storage issues in terms of fuel sources. When we start looking at this idea about the type 3 diabetes, the insulin resistance within the neurons, neurons themselves are not insulin sensitive in the way in which you think about insulin sensitive. That is, they are not glucose storing tissues. They don't need insulin to get glucose into the cells. And so one of the kind of hot button topics that you start hearing about and what a lot of people talk about when it comes to nutrition, metabolism, and weight issues is this idea about controlling sugar, controlling glucose, controlling sucrose within the foods so as to not spike insulin. That spike of insulin will occur if we happen to have a consumption of glucose at greater than 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram of body mass. So that's somewhere between a half to about a sixth of a gram per pound in terms of simple conversions within a meal within an hour of consumption. And so that's what we're talking about in terms of that scariness about glucose or added, quote unquote, added sugars in our food sources as it relates to this insulin spiking and why you hear all these experts put quotes around that, talking about needing to control how much glucose you eat and get all scary talk whenever they see even 1 gram of sugar or 2 grams of sugar or 10 grams of sugar on a food label, not realizing that for the average weight adult within the United States, you need to have somewhere in between 35 and 70 grams of sugar in order to stimulate an insulin spike. And that's grams of sugar consumed within 1 hour to trigger enough absorption in order to get a spike of insulin. But when we start looking at insulin responses at the neuronal level, what we're talking about is we're talking about growth responses. We're talking about responses that are going to allow for those synapses to remain. And so people who have metabolic disease issues, people who have overfatness issues, people who are suffering from insulin insensitivity issues, where they're not responding to insulin at the peripheral tissues, they can have a very similar issue centrally within the cerebral cortex, within the brain. And what that response is going to lead to is a loss of synapse connection points, but not just synapse connection points. It's also going to reduce the rate of growing new synapses, which is going to mean that we have less to start with when we start to lose stuff. And we are constantly losing those connection points based off of how often we are using stuff, which is why when we start looking at this idea about learning things, it's about being multimodal in your learning, not just listening, not just watching, but actually doing a combination of watching and reading and listening, or watching and reading, listening and writing, where you're pulling multiple things together. This is something that we talked about in terms of issues as relates to brain health for students and learning, and issues for brain health as relates to older individuals, which is in a different discussion that we've had previously. But when we start looking at that insulin responsiveness, one of the things that has been noted is that those who are have insulin sensitive issues have dementia issues as well. And the reason why they have dementia issues as well is because of the loss of synaptic connection points, the loss of growth signaling coming away from that neuron at the signal, coming away from the insulin signaling on that neuron to keep that synapse strong and to allow for that synaptic growth to take place. But that's only half of the conversation. We start looking at what the new research is pointing to. When we start looking at some of the animal models, there's been a recent set of studies that have come out that have looked at glycogen metabolism taking place within the neurons and within the astrocytes. Neurons are what's referred to as a glucose-obligated tissue. That means that they want to use glucose and they prefer to use glucose. And for lack of a better analogy, they only can use glucose in order to do their fuel metabolism, in order to get the ATP energy necessary for the neurons to function. When there is excessive amounts of glucose available, or when there is a deficit in a specific enzyme, a glycogen phosphorylase enzyme, what ends up happening is that we get this disruption taking place. And that disruption in that glycogen phosphorylasing enzyme impacts the ability for the astrocytes to free up glucose available to the cell. But not only does it impact the ability for, it's going to impact the ability for that the astrocytes to
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Free up glucose for the cell, but it's also going to have impacts at other places. And what it's going to do is we get this change, and that change leads to an accumulation of glycogen as opposed to a utilization of glucose by the neurons themselves. And so the astrocytes, those little kind of specialized helper cells for the neurons, start to change their metabolism, and that change in metabolism causes a change in the neuron metabolism. And what that does is it starts to lead to an accumulation of glycogen in and around neurons. And that should not be taking place. That buildup is going to lead to a disease progression. And so the tau and the amyloid that we start looking at in terms of this cause-effect relationship, which isn't really a cause-effect relationship, but is more of a correlative relationship, that tau clumps with the amyloid, or clumps around itself, or amyloids clumps with amyloids. It's actually binding to the sugars that are trapped there, the glycogen that's trapped there. So glycogen is glucose units, glucose molecules that are stuck together. And when that glycogen, which should be stored at very, 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 very low levels, starts to accumulate, it starts to disrupt other enzyme actions. It starts to disrupt something known as the pentose phosphate pathway, which is responsible for creating energy molecules that are going to move hydrogens around during the process of generating ATP, the NADH in particular, as well as a secondary amino acid known as glutamine. And the NAD and the glutamine are antioxidants. And so when we start to have this disruption, because the glycogen phosphorylase enzymes get disrupted, that leads to the inability to utilize glucose and the accumulation of glycogen in areas that we should not accumulate glycogen. What ends up happening is that we start to disrupt these antioxidant pathways, and that leads to oxidative stress. And it's the oxidative stress that causes the accumulation of the metabolic waste, that causes the accumulation of the proteins that we start associating with the neurodegenerative diseases, that aren't causing the neurodegenerative diseases, but are simply just associated with the neurodegenerative diseases. If we start to have changes in nutrition, where we start to change how much glucose load we have, how much sugar we have, so we're on, say, like a low-carb diet, what most people refer to as a ketogenic diet, or if we are somehow pharmacologically reducing glucose in the blood by taking an anti-glycemic medicine or one of the newfangled GLP-1 agonist drugs that we're trying to use for losing weight, even though it's an anti-diabetic drug. What all of those drugs are doing, what the restriction on carbohydrates is doing, is it's reducing the total amount of glucose available. And by reducing the total amount of glucose available, what it's doing is it's reducing that ability to have a glycogen store. And that reduction in glycogen store for individuals that have metabolic issues means that that disrupted enzyme, that disrupted glycogen phosphatase enzyme, isn't going to allow for additional glycogen to be stored, which means that we're not going to have the oxidative stress taking place because we're not going to have an impact on the pentose pathway, on the ability to produce the NADHs, or on glutamine. And so we're going to have an antioxidant presence within the neurons. And by having an antioxidant presence within the neurons, we're going to reduce relative oxidative stress. And by reducing relative oxidative stress, we reduce the amount of metabolic stress on the neurons, which means the neurons are able to function correctly, which is what we want to take place. And so when we start looking at all of this evidence that we have in terms of individuals on a ketogenic diet having benefits if they happen to have neurodegeneration in their family or are suffering from neurodegeneration, what we're seeing is that it's not the diet itself that's causing the protection. It's the reduction in oxidative stress that's causing the protection. And so for individuals that happen to have a dysfunction in that enzyme, reducing glycemic load, reducing glucose load, acts as a protection against neurodegeneration and neurodegenerative diseases. It's not necessarily saying, oh, well, if we can put everybody on a low-carb diet, it's going to be protection against dementia, because not everybody has the issues with the genes. The other thing that's come to light recently and got a lot of press is some early evidence in animal model about lithium and lithium expression and lithium utilization as relates to prevention of oxidative stress and metabolic stress in at least rodent models, with the generalization indicating that it's probably going to be true for human models or for humans, even though we haven't had the research done on it yet. What's noted within the lithium is that there seems to be some causal relationship that we can attribute to having lower levels of lithium, or what's usually referred to as lithium depletion, and early set Alzheimer's. That is Alzheimer's early onset. And one of the things that is being pointed to within the research is that for those who have a marked decrease in lithium, there seems to be changes in the earliest parts of memory loss, the early stage memory loss. And that is going to impact cognitive health and cognitive decline for those who have mild to full Alzheimer's issues. The lithium is something that is naturally occurring. We're not talking about needing to take lithium as a supplement. We're not talking about needing to take lithium as a drug. Lithium is something that we want to have in very, 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 very small amounts. It's a microgrammed nutrient, if you want to think about it that way, in terms of our nutrient loads and what we need in terms of major, minor, and trace elements. It's a trace element in terms of what's necessary. We get it naturally from most of what we eat. Those researchers that pointed out the linkage that is there between the lithium depletion and the early onset Alzheimer's went and did rodent studies. They did studies on mice. And the mice that were put onto a restricted diet of lithium saw lithium levels be depleted, and those lithium levels started to be in a depleted range that was similar to what they saw with the Alzheimer's brains on autopsy. Once again, we have to remember that when we're talking about neurodegenerative diseases, it's almost impossible to diagnose while the person's alive. It's always a like diagnosis where the true diagnosing comes from studying the brain post-mortem after death during autopsy. What the researchers did is that they, with the lithium depletion, is that they saw immune cell activation and the inability to break down the tau proteins and the amyloid proteins in and around the axons and the synapses. And so the immune cells within the brains that were referred to as microglia, part of what they're going to do is they're going to work with that glyphamic system in order to clear out the metabolic wastes. And some of that metabolic waste is the amyloid protein. Some of that metabolic waste is the tau protein. And if I have a genetic predisposition to having poor functioning in terms of that microglial function or overproduction of the amyloid proteins, I am predisposed to having Alzheimer's-like issues. And so what the researchers showed is that with those mice, if they got put on a lithium diet or a lithium-enriched diet, for those that have predisposition, the disease-related damage started to drop, and they started to see a restoration of memory functions. And if they're able to maintain their lithium levels through this early onset of Alzheimer's, it showed very similar responses to what has been shown in terms of not really preventative treatment, but lifestyle treatment, I guess is the best way of putting it, for individuals that are in living facilities, active living facilities, where they did a lot of cognitive work with physical activity work, where they did a combination of high amounts of cognitive function with high amounts of physical activity function, where we saw this plateauing effect of loss, where they saw the same thing happening in terms of these mice when they got put onto a lithium-enriched diet. But what this doesn't mean is that we have to go out and start to supplement with lithium. We don't have to all start taking extra lithium. We don't have to look at, do I need more lithium in my diet? Because once again, we get it naturally with most of the things that we eat in terms of the amounts that we need. The other thing we have to remember in terms of this is that it's predominantly done with animal models. And so what's happening within the animal is not going to be the same as what's happening with us in terms of responses that we might have. And so we have to be very cognizant of, could lithium actually explain the onset or the alleviation of it? Is it a cause and effect, or is it a correlative issue? And so this is where we have to be kind of very cognizant of the fact that it's early in the research in terms of what we know. And so we do know that there are a host of metabolic factors that are coming into play as it relates to the onset of Alzheimer's. We understand that the recent findings indicate that when we start having accumulation of glucose in the form of glycogen within the brain, we start having disruption of some of the antioxidant properties taking place within the neurons, which leads to oxidative stress. We do know that if we have a depletion of lithium within the cerebrospinal fluid flow, we're going to have a disruption in microglial function, which is going to disrupt the flow of within the glyphatic system in terms of the clearance of metabolic wastes. The other thing that's kind of interesting, and this is kind of extremely speculative on my part, is the lithium depletion and some of the psychoactive responses that we see with people who have Alzheimer's, particularly the mood instability issues, and the fact that lithium is a very powerful mood stabilizer that we see. And so one of the things that might that could be interesting in terms of research that is not there yet is the is how we can use mood stabilizing drugs as a possible intervention for Alzheimer's and for neurodegenerative dementia. There is some talk about doing microdosing on lithium. Once again, we don't need whole hosts of lithium. We don't need large doses of lithium to start with. And we don't want to have accumulation of lithium because it does have issues in terms of toxicity issues if it starts to accumulate. We do know that we have to worry about that enzyme in terms of glycophosphorylation. The principal enzyme that we're looking at here is the GSK3 beta, the glycogen synthase kinase 3 beta, as being the principal site where we're having issues in terms of that glycogen processing, with some indication that we might have a combination of issues come into play in terms of metabolic effects, in terms of metabolic disease, in terms of chronic inflammation, in terms of oxidative stress impacting that enzyme, in terms of its overall functionality. The paradigm shift that we're seeing right now within the research is indicating that we have new avenues of pursuit. We have new avenues of research that we can go. We have new recommendations that we can make as relates to how we can go about treating Alzheimer's once Alzheimer has set in, once neurodegeneration has set in, as relates to this issue in terms of metabolic effects. And so there is a host of evidence that does support the fact, or does answer the question, that yes, neurodegenerative diseases, dementia, Alzheimer's, those factors seem to be a metabolic issue, seem to have at the heart of the disease a metabolic cause. And that metabolic cause seems to be linked with oxidative stress and chronic inflammation leading to oxidative stress, or metabolic disruption leading to oxidative stress. And we can kind of work on preventing that metabolic stress, that oxidative stress, both in terms of dietary restrictions as well as in terms of physical activity, where increasing physical activity will lead to a normalization of insulin sensitivity and normalization of insulin response, not just at our insulin-sensitive tissues as relates to glucose uptake, skeletal muscle, liver, and adipose tissue, but also insulin response at all of the other tissues that need insulin in terms of growth factors, in terms of being a growth signal, because once again, insulin's primary action is to grow tissues, even though it's always talked about in terms of glucose homeostasis. But we can also look at it in terms of a dietary restriction, where if I know that I have a predisposition for having a neurodegenerative disease, if multiple family members have neurodegenerative diseases, if I have a lifestyle that causes me to have issues related to overfatness, changing dietary restrictions, changing what is or is not within my food sources, away from a high carbohydrate to a moderate to low carbohydrate, almost a ketogenic diet, can allow for prevention of the onset of issues. It will reduce the glycemic load, and by reducing the glycemic load, it can help to normalize how much glycogen is being stored at the astrocytes and around the neurons in terms of that availability and the linkage that we have for the glycogen stores to the oxidative stress and the neurodegenerative diseases that we look at in terms of dementia issues, in terms of Alzheimer's issues for people. Thanks for listening. Hopefully got a little bit out of the conversation as it relates to our neurodegenerative diseases, a metabolic issue. Is dementia and Alzheimer's a metabolic issue? And what does the most recent studies coming out tell us about the impact that metabolism has on the onset of those diseases? If you have questions about what was presented, please make sure you leave it to us in comments. Please make sure you email it to us. We'd be more than happy to discuss it in future discussions or write about it in the Substack for future clarifications. Please make sure you're following us here on the podcast as well as on YouTube, the written stuff in Substack, as well as the quick takes we post to Instagram and to Threads. Stay tuned for future discussions on the myths and misconceptions we have about how the human body works and how we can go about living a healthy lifestyle.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.